hesitate to talk about all schools in general because schools are made up of individual students attending them.
The public schools here are doing worse than they did.
Michigan schools need to do better. There is no doubt about it.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos struggled on 60 Minutes last night to answer some pretty basic questions from Leslie Stahl. We're going to look at what DeVos has accomplished as the nation's education chief in a few minutes. First, though, the White House has rolled out gun policy proposals. They include giving teachers, quote, rigorous firearms training, tightening background checks, and banning bump stocks, but no raising the minimum age to buy a gun, as Trump had previously proposed. David Nakamura is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so quickly lay out some of these proposals.
Yeah, so the biggest one, of course, is the president has been talking a lot about arming teachers. The White House said yesterday that they would help states in efforts to do so, although they weren't clear exactly what that means, to try to give training to teachers who come forward and volunteer for this. This idea has been sharply opposed by the National Education Association, but the White House is moving forward on this. They're not necessarily proposing more funding, but just trying to help states find ways to provide this training if necessary. But as you mentioned, there's a number of things that were not in this bill that the president had suggested he was supportive of a few weeks ago when he was having some roundtable discussions with lawmakers. And one of those is raising the age of to buy an assault rifle from 18 to 21. The president said he was for that, but the White House has not added that in here. So it's fairly disappointing to Democrats and others who thought maybe this president would support some more sweeping efforts.
So why did he backpedal on that idea of raising the age to 21?
The White House has talked about the idea that, you know, I think critics say, look, it's the NRA having influence again. Their NRA is, and its big money contributions is, stopping this legislation from moving forward. The White House, says that they just don't see the support among Republicans on the Hill, whether that's the NRA's influence or not. They're saying it doesn't make sense to try to move forward with a big fight. I think others would say this president has, you know, certainly a base of conservative voters. And if he gave cover to some lawmakers, maybe they could pass some sort of stronger restrictions, including that age provision. But again, the White House is not doing this. And I think even when the president suggested he was open to this idea, there were many who thought he eventually would not support it because his advisors would get to him, the NRA and others would get to him. And the president did have a private meeting with NRA officials shortly after he had said publicly he was supportive of this. So not surprising, we saw the same kind of inaction in Congress in 2013 after the mass shooting at Newtown that killed 20 first graders, everybody mm-hmm. remembers. Yeah. The White House is backing this Cornyn bill in Congress that would beef up some of the federal background checks, but it's not a universal background check system. So Democrats mm-hmm. and others saying this, it's very limited.
Okay, so what's going on with this Federal Commission on School Safety that Betsy DeVos is going to chair? What is that?
So I think a lot of people roll their eyes at these kind of federal commissions, blue ribbon commissions. Even President Trump yesterday at a speech at a campaign rally in Pennsylvania poo-pooed the idea of some sort of commission on sort of drug the drug war or drug reform. But now he's created one on school safety and gun violence. And I think some of this is to sort of put off tough decisions and suggest that he's taking action on some of these things we talked about gun safety that he is not supporting now and saying we're still going to examine it, we're going to look at it more. But DeVos, as you all mentioned in the tease, is under a lot of scrutiny for her role as schools chief. And I think her presence here will be controversial in and of itself, but also the provisions themselves. If you have a commission taking many months to study things that have already been studied for a long time, it doesn't bode well for anything more serious to really be done.
All right, David, thank you.
Sure.
That's David Nakamura. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Well, let's talk more about Secretary DeVos with Caitlin Emma, education reporter at Politico Pro. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, what did you think of her interview last night on 60 Minutes?
So certainly it's going, I guess you could say, viral in a way that her confirmation hearing did last year, circa sort of the whole call around, you know, guns and bears and grizzly bears in school or what have you. That being said, I was just sort of looking at Twitter and talking to some other education reporters who follow Betsy DeVos regularly. And, you know, we're all sort of, you know, maybe we need a fresher pair of eyes, but we're all sort of, thinking like this is typically how she sounds when she's pressed on policy. You know, that being said, Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes had a lot of time with her and was able to pin her down on a number of answers that, you know, I think she struggled to answer. But in terms of this being in a regular or atypical gaffe, that's not exactly the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what does it say about what she has or has not accomplished in her tenure? What has she done to boost low-performing schools, if anything?
She hasn't been able to accomplish a lot that she originally, you know, set out to do. She was very passionate. She was a very passionate advocate of expanding school choice, like charter schools or private school vouchers. And, you know, on the campaign trail, President Trump said that he wanted to invest $20 billion into doing this. But that proposal on Capitol Hill has gone absolutely nowhere. Moderate Republicans are even hesitant to embrace something like that. The Trump administration's budget proposals around expanding school choice haven't gone anywhere. So really, her hands are tied. And historically, the role of education secretary is not a powerful one. They don't have a lot of influence over the nation's schools. So the most that she can do is what she has been doing, which is using the bully pulpit to sort of talk about schools that she thinks look innovative and visit these schools and highlight them. Her push this year and her push in the coming year will be around, you know, quote-unquote, rethinking school and questioning sort of like how and why and where students learn. And, you know, traditional public school is outdated and it's failing school students, et cetera. So that's about as much as she can do. But in terms of concrete policy proposals, she really hasn't had a lot of success.
What about when it comes to violence and gun policies at schools? Does she have any influence there?
Certainly now it seems as though she does, since she's been appointed to this commission that's going to, you know, review a number of school safety policy proposals, including reviewing a 2014 directive from the Obama administration on school discipline. Republicans are now looking at that school discipline directive and linking it to what happened in Parkland, Florida, and saying that it might have contributed to school violence there. There's little evidence for that. This directive in 2014, you know, essentially aimed at ensuring that school districts weren't discriminating against students when they were disciplining them. But still, the White House named that last night as a priority for its school safety review. So we might see that repealed. And in terms of authority, she does have a lot of authority when it comes to, you know, repealing these Obama-era regulatory efforts.
Right. So we saw her try to do that when it came to the sexual harassment policies.
Yes.
Correct?
And that's still currently underway. I mean, in that vein, she has seen success in rolling back Obama era policies around campus sexual assault, transgender students, and, you know, their access to bathrooms and locker rooms and other school facilities, things like that. But on school choice, she hasn't had a lot of success.
So many Trump staffers have resigned or they've been fired. And so where is she in terms of surviving the rest of the term?
Well, she has said time and again that she plans to stay on for the duration of the president's first term. We also had a story with her last year written by a colleague here of mine for Politico magazine. And, you know, he sort of said, you know, a lot of folks underestimate, I guess, the passion that somebody like her has for doing this job when they, you know, it's really not a job that they have to do. As we're all familiar by now, she's a wealthy, you know, billionaire who could really be doing anything else. So she certainly has at least assured the media that she'll be around for four more years, but that remains to be seen.
All right. Caitlin Emma, education reporter for Politico Pro. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gun policy will also play a role in southwestern Pennsylvania tomorrow when voters head to the polls to choose a new congressman. Their last congressman, the pro-life Tim Murphy, resigned after news broke that he asked his mistress to get an abortion. The district, which encompasses parts of Appalachia, has a strong base of blue-collar workers. Trump won it by 19 points. Eliza Griswold has been covering the region for The New Yorker. She's on the line now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you've spent a lot of time in this part of Pennsylvania. Tell us about the area and the two candidates, Democrat Connor Lamb and Republican Rick Saccone.
Sure. The area itself is very complex. And really, in terms of this district alone, encompasses to the south Appalachia and to the north the wealthy suburbs of Pittsburgh. So in this district alone, you have really a cross-section, an economic cross-section at least, of, you know, who we would see nationwide. You know, race-wise, this is a district that is 96% white.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys have a broad base of concerns, and this is old steel country where, you know, for decades now, the region has been struggling with the industrial collapse, and most recently, the rise of natural gas, of fracking, has replaced some of the revenue that coal and steel used to bring to the area. So it's really an area hard hit by industrial collapse, yet possibly on the verge of a renaissance, and very, very conservative socially, more liberal economically, at least in terms of unions. And that's the base that Connor Lamb is going to have to win tomorrow in order to secure election.
Okay, so Connor Lamb, he's a 33-year-old. He's a Marine. He's a former federal prosecutor. He is very pro-life, he says, very pro-gun. So he seems to fit in to the district by your description. And yet, this is a red, red district. And so what about the Republican, Saccone? He says, I was Trump before Trump was Trump. How's that playing?
Yeah, so Rick Saccone, you know, here's the thing. Rick Saccone is incredibly conservative. He's best known for legislation surrounding, you know, he's wanted to have In God We Trust placed more prominently in Pennsylvania's public schools. He's wanted the Ten Commandments posted publicly throughout Pennsylvania. That's most of the legislation that he has put forward. Where he does not have popular support among these voters is that he votes against labor unions. He votes as conservatives would call it, the right to work. So he votes against protecting labor, and labor has a long, long history here. Before steel, this is labor country. This is organized labor, organized unions, and that is, although they are socially conservative, that is the demographic that Lamb needs to pick off and looks likely to do so.
So is this race also a referendum on the power of the unions to get out the vote?
I would say it's more a referendum on the unions to get out the vote than it is a referendum on Trump. Because what I keep seeing in the national press that does not bear up on the ground is, well, certainly is this the beginning of the blue wave? And is this, you know, does support of Connor Lamb indicate disaffection with President Trump? And many of the voters I've spoken to over the years, who I go to speak to again and again, are still staunch Trump supporters, but they are going to vote for Lamb, if that makes sense. So is it a referendum on labor getting out the vote? It is, but it, again, it's plays out more complexly on the ground than it seems to under any one guise.
And they want to vote for Lamb because they don't like Saccone?
They want to vote for Lamb because Saccone is not going to protect their labor rights at all. And they want to vote for who their union tells them to vote for, right? And I'll tell you what else, that this really surprised me. So one of the things that's been going on is that we've seen possibly the largest largest outside funding of like congressional pushback against the Lamb campaign. So tens of millions of dollars flooding from Republican concerns, super PACs, the RNC, into the region to air anti-Lamb campaign commercials, essentially. And for some of the voters I talked to, Trump voters, they were so appalled by this negative campaigning that they were actually going to vote for Lamb because of it.
Wow, interesting. Okay, well, speaking of Trump, here he is in his rally on Saturday night campaigning for Saccone in Pennsylvania.
We just had a poll. We're more popular now than we were on Election Day. This guy should win easily, and he's going to win easily. You got to know him. He's an extraordinary person. Go out and vote on Tuesday for Rick Saccone. Rick, go ahead.
Okay, so he's out there for Rick Saccone, but he really didn't talk much about Rick Saccone during that rally. He talked more about himself and it seemed like a rally for Trump, like going back to the presidential campaign. How enthusiastic is Trump for Saccone, and is that a good thing in this district?
So it would be a good thing if Trump were really enthusiastic for Saccone, but you are absolutely right. The rally, he barely mentioned Saccone. He's not going to, after Roy Moore, he's really cautious. He doesn't want to have another big loss, and he's likely to face it. Today, even, we had Saccone, you know, saying basically a concession speech in advance, saying, you know, this is a Democratic district, blah, blah, blah. So these guys are poised to lose it, and Trump is already distancing himself. And what you hear in that speech is that he's continually putting the onus on Saccone, like, you better win it, bunny, because we in Make America Great Again are more popular than ever, and really, really basically shedding light between the two of them so that he retains popularity. Well, his popularity is not affected by a loss on behalf of Saccone.
Right. And so, you know, you seemed to say earlier that that might be the case, that this might just be, you know, the unique aspect of this race and the unions rather than a referendum on Trump. And yet we are looking at this, or the, you know, national media is looking at this as something more significant in terms of what could happen in November. What lessons do you think could come out of this for other races?
So I do think that although this may not be a referendum on Trump, I do think that a Lamb victory could encourage other Democratic candidates to come forward, and also encourage other, you know, staunch Republicans to split from their party if they saw candidates who were able to toe a middle line. So although I don't think it is, you know, all of these things, of course, especially after years in a place, bear out differently on the ground. So it was really important to me in my reporting and writing about the election to make clear that this wasn't some blanket referendum on Trump. That said, a victory by Conor Lamb could certainly encourage others across the country as midterms come to both run on Democratic platforms, and also those voters who don't want to be disloyal to the Republican Party to be able to find room to vote for Democrats.
Eliza Griswold covering the special election in Pennsylvania. It's tomorrow. She's covering it for The New Yorker, where you can read her story on Conor Lamb. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the payment to porn star Stormy Daniels may have violated federal election law. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Porn star Stormy Daniels is offering to return $130,000 she says she was paid to keep quiet about an affair she had with President Trump. In exchange, she wants to speak freely about that affair and share any photos, any texts, or videos she has relating to the president. The offer follows news last week that the president's lawyer used a Trump Organization email account to secure Daniels' payment in 2016. And some legal experts say that's likely a violation of federal election law. Well, our own legal expert is here to talk us through this. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School, and she joins us every Monday. Hi.
Hi. And a Stormy Daniels expert, as it turns out.
I guess you are. So why would this payment be a violation of federal election law?
Well, because it starts to look like the payment was made in furtherance of campaign purposes, in which case it's something called an in-kind campaign contribution, and it would be subject to federal limits. It will surprise no one to know that federal limits are actually much lower than $130,000. They're lower than $3,000. So the fact that Mr. Cohen used a Trump Organization email, the fact that the payment was made very closely right before the election, makes it look like this was a payment to help candidate Trump become President Trump.
Even though Michael Cohen, the lawyer, has said that this was his personal money.
That's fine if that's his own money, but if it looks like he's using his own money to support the campaign and to support candidate Trump, then his own money is subject to the federal campaign contribution limits. Mm. Now, there's a separate problem, actually, if it was President Trump's money, because in that case, candidates are not limited in how much they can contribute to their own campaigns, but they do have to disclose that money. So if this was President Trump's money, then there's an issue of whether or not there was an active failure to disclose this payment on a federal election campaign form.
And what about the fact that they used this email account? rather than a private email account.
Well, the email account makes it look like exactly what Mr. Cohen said it wasn't, where Michael Cohen said, look, the president had nothing to do with this. He's very much separate and distinct from this payment. And now the fact that Michael Cohen used a Trump Organization email address, the fact that the payment was made so close to the election, it looks like actually candidate Trump could have known about this, in which case then it looks like an in-kind campaign contribution.
So had this payment been made, let's say, 2 years earlier, before Donald Trump had declared his candidacy, this wouldn't be an issue?
I don't want to say it absolutely wouldn't be an issue, but it would be a much more attenuated case. It's the timing, it's the other facts like the email address that make it look like, again, this was a donation to the campaign, kind of akin to, let's say, Michael Cohen wanted to give free legal services. That would be like an in-kind contribution. Or let's say Michael Cohen wanted to talk to candidate Trump about putting out an ad that said that, you know, candidate Trump at that point has great legal minds at his disposal. If they talk about that expenditure, then it's an in-kind contribution and it's subject to the limits again.
And what kinds of consequences could Trump or Michael Cohen face if they have been, if they're found to have violated this law?
Well, they could face both civil and criminal penalties. My strong suspicion is that it's going to be a civil penalty, meaning money, if there is found to be a violation.
All right. So what about the fact that this deal, apparently, she says, Stormy Daniels says that this deal was never in effect because Trump failed to sign it. But Michael Cohen did sign it. So how much does the signature matter?
Yeah, this is an issue of contract law, which I frankly think is her kind of way to open the door to this lawsuit and her way to open the door to telling her story. So what she's basically saying is that non-disclosure agreement I signed, it's not valid. And so I should be able to tell my story. And I think that her legal claim on that grounds is a bit shaky, frankly. But if you notice, she is actually allowed to now kind of convey her narrative without undoing the non-disclosure agreement. So it's actually a good legal tactic to allow her to tell her side of the tale.
Well, right, because if he says, oh, that's not okay, then he's actually acknowledging that this happened in the first place, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. There's all sorts of difficult legal implications for President Trump. Now, I do think just based on contract law, I'm not sure this is a terrifically successful claim for her. But based on her desire to get into court and maybe expand this case so that you could take the president's deposition, so that you could ask the president additional questions like, have you ever paid hush money to other people with whom you had an affair with? In that case, it's actually a successful tactic.
All right, let's turn to another story in the news, tangentially related. The New York Times reporting over the weekend that the president is in talks with the lawyer who represented Bill Clinton during his impeachment proceedings about joining the White House. And this lawyer's name is Emmett T. Flood. It's a great name. Donald Trump says that's not true, but the Times is saying, yeah, it is. We reported it out. So what does this say to you?
Well, it does not indicate to me. I know that the headline have been some version of President Trump seeks help from impeachment lawyer. Now, Mr. Flood is not just an impeachment lawyer. He happens to have helped President Clinton during his impeachment process, but he has a wealth of experience and information on a variety of topics, including white collar crime defense. And so I think it's important for us to know that just because you want a high powered lawyer who has a ton of knowledge and experience doesn't mean, oh, now it's we're headed towards an impeachment. And so what it means is that the Trump administration has been, I understand, looking to get Mr. Flood on board for a long time and continues to want to get Mr. Flood on board. And I think what it also means is there's an acknowledgement that the Mueller investigation is not wrapping up by Friday and that it's important to get people who have deep knowledge in this area on the team.
And Bloomberg is reporting that Mueller might want to put off his decision on whether to charge Trump with obstruction of justice for firing FBI chief, former FBI chief James Comey, among other things. Why would he do that?
I think it's a win-win for Mueller to put off the obstruction issue, because if you think about it. So if he charges Trump with obstruction of justice now, then one, the case kind of explodes and Trump might decide try to fire Mueller. And Mueller would lose his leverage over other potential witnesses and people that he wants to interview. If he does not charge President Trump with obstruction of justice now, then I think President Trump and surrogates can say, look, this case is much ado about nothing, and we should really just try and speed up the end of the special counsel investigation. So I think for Robert Mueller, for him to continue to go through the other charges and the other actors makes all the sense in the world.
Right. Even though there is some news that the White House may have floated this idea that Trump will testify if Mueller agrees to wrap it up within a couple of months.
Well, you know, I know that there's been a lot of up and back about under what conditions President Trump will testify. And, you know, there have been some jokes that President Trump has more conditions for his meeting with Mueller than he does with the leadership of North Korea, which frankly seems to be true. And so I don't think we know what the conditions are. And frankly, that precondition is a little strange to me. So as a special counsel, and your listeners have heard me say this before, you have to go where the evidence takes you. So you can't promise to wrap up by a date certain because you don't know what information is going to come out of the next interview. So that, frankly, seems to be a little curious to me.
Also, it appears that Mueller would never agree to something like that. It doesn't seem logical.
If Mueller is anything, he seems to be a very logical person, and it does not feel like this would be a great deal for Robert Mueller, or one, frankly, that any prosecutor or special counsel with his level of experience would ever take.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, South by Southwest starts up tomorrow in Austin, Texas. KCRW will be there, as usual. Our own Jason Bentley, neck deep in the frenzy.
You've got to just embrace that and head out and just get it done. You know, I've seen as many as 12 or 13 bands in one day.
We'll tell you about some of the bands KCRW is highlighting at South by Southwest. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Every year around this time, the city of Austin, Texas, gives itself over to music and film, particularly music. Bands and solo artists perform in every nook and cranny of that city. Of course, I'm talking about South by Southwest. It's become a must-do in the lives of indie artists and music executives, and also KCRW. We're always there to showcase and to check out some of the new talent. Our music director, Jason Bentley, is always there. And he's here
so
now.
Excited to be headed back to Austin.
So much fun. So you've been going for how many years?
Too many to
50,
remember.
60.
Yeah, so many years, but it's always a pleasure.
It began in 1987.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually went in 1989.
Wow. And
I know.
I'm sure very different
conference
at that time.
Yeah, it wasn't really a conference. It was just a bunch of bands playing in bars is basically what it was.
Well, that's still an important part of the experience.
I know, and super fun. So this time around, how many people, how many bands? Is it just going to be like a mini city descending on another city?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many total, but over 1,000 bands,
yeah.
I'm sure. And the thing is, a band will play maybe 6, 7, 8 times through the week.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So it's a full bore.
Yeah. Okay. So, but KCRW has these showcases, right? These daytime and evening showcases.
That's right. We do a nighttime showcase on Tuesday of this week. And then Wednesday, we take it on over to the Austin Convention Center for a daytime showcase.
Oh, fun. Yeah. Okay. So let's preview some of the bands that you're going to be showcasing.
Cool.
One of them is Y Oak.
Yes.
And, tell us a little bit about them.
Well, they are from Baltimore. They're a duo. They've been around for a while, but we just have really enjoyed the latest music we've heard from them. So we're just, you know, taking a leap of faith and putting them on the showcase. But I really like the songs that we've got so far. One in particular is called The Louder I Call, The Faster It Runs.
Time.
just a duo?
It is. Yeah. Nice. Yep. And, you know, this is one of the more veteran acts on our showcase. Most of what we present are newcomers. I'm loving this stuff new from Y-Oak.
And you have someone else on the daytime showcase named Sudan Archives?
Yes, this is a young...
From Sudan?
But inspired by Sudanese music, traditional music. She plays solo, violin, and just is really inventive and experimental. And we've all been captivated by, in particular, there's a song called Come My Way.
So that's Sudan Archives with Come My Way. And Jason, you also then have the evening showcase. Is it a different vibe at night?
Yeah, I mean, the Austin Convention Center doesn't sound like a sexy venue for a showcase, but it is kind of a best-kept secret because it's air-conditioned and it's comfy, and the sound is pristine there at that showcase. The problem with the nighttime showcases is it's such a hustle and bustle, and bands only get to line check. They don't get a proper sound check a lot of times, and it's a race to get them on. So it's sometimes at the expense of sound quality. It's just chaos, but it's part of the fun is bands just going for it. The day showcase is more of a relaxed, pristine listening, and nighttime is just let's go for it. Everybody just jam out.
Okay, so one of the bands is Jade Bird.
Really promising young woman. She's from England, but her sound is more of an Americana, American folk rock kind of sound. I think she's 20 years old, and she is just churning out some very cool stuff.
We know each other when we were very young. High school sweethearts or something American. Now we become what I only see photos. She's what I thought, something American. Something American. But you don't call.
Jade Bird playing her song Something American. She is British.
She's British.
From Northumberland, which is in the northern part of England.
I know, it's strange, isn't it?
And she sounds like a country music star from here.
Yeah, and I think she will be. She just has a beautiful voice and a great attitude. I've met her before, and she's something special.
Okay, so that's one of the artists, Jade Bird, performing at KCRW's Evening Showcase at South by Southwest. And should we hear one more?
Yeah, let's go with Jordan Rockeye. He actually just performed at KCRW last week, so we got a little bit of a preview with him and met him. And he's more of a British jazz musician coming out of a very exciting and thriving London scene these days, which also includes a luminary by the name of Tom Misch, who we're excited about. Same sort of crew. And his sound goes well beyond his 25 years of age. He's just, the sound is so cool and sophisticated. And we're pleased to present him this year.
Cool vibes of Jordan Rockeye. It's hard to believe he's so young. He's 25 years old. So let's hear from a grizzled veteran, Cut Chemist.
Yeah. L.A. music fans will know Cut Chemist. He started out in Ozo Motley way back in the day. He's part of Jurassic 5. He's ever the innovator. I remember seeing him perform different times, and he'll kind of take apart a turntable and play a record in a different way that you never thought was possible, like upside down
really?
Or something strange. But that's also his approach to music, is that he's just very inventive. And this new album, which is called Die Cut, Right on Time, just came out, and we're pleased to showcase him. And he's an old friend of KCRW, and everyone will know him.
All right. Girl, we can do some things. She gave me headphones. Said, have you heard this sound? I think I've heard this one is totally underground. Yeah. I wouldn't let her go then, she wouldn't let me go. Just ask the neighbors, man, it's unbelievable. Yeah. I played the morning rising, she played the setting sun. She said she couldn't stay when her night had just begun. Yeah. So what's the altitude? I said it's out of sight. What's with the attitude? And she said it's alright. So what's the altitude? I said it's out of sight. Without abandon, we dance, we party all night. We party all night. We party all night. We party all night.
And that's Charlie Tuna on the track from Jurassic 5.
Oh, right. Okay, rapping. And it's spelled Charlie.
It's Charlie.
Tuna. Tuna. Yeah. I love that.
I don't know if he's going to be down in South by with Cut Chemist, but it's going to be a spectacle no matter what.
Okay, so he'll be at the evening showcase?
That's right, and he's going to wrap it up. He's sort of the final act, the headliner.
Wrap it up?
Yeah.
Okay, I like that. Like fish wrap. Okay, so how do you survive South by with all those people? Like, how do you get a seat at a table, at a restaurant? How do you even negotiate the streets? It's got to be pandemonium.
It is a little bit, but I enjoy it. You got to just embrace that and head out and just get it done. You know, I've seen as many as 12 or 13 bands in one day. And I really enjoy also going from one genre to the next. Because at KCRW, we do reflect so much musically. And so I feel like that's my job, is to go explore all sorts of styles of music. And it's all there in Austin. So it's just a lot of fun, and you just have to embrace the chaos.
Okay, embrace it. KCRW's music director, Jason Bentley, at South by Southwest. And you're not traveling alone.
Joined by Ann Litt and Jose Galvan as part of the KCRW crew.
Okay, well, have fun.
Thank you.
So what's the altitude? I said it's out of sight. What's with the attitude? And she said it's all right. So what's the altitude? I said it's out of sight. Without abandon, we dance, we party all night.
Coming up, is it March insanity that USC was excluded from March Madness? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The NCAA men's basketball tournament begins tomorrow, and one Southern California team that has twice made it to the Final Four will be left out of March Madness completely. USC was not selected as one of the 68 teams to compete in the Big Dance. Matt Money Smith is here to talk about why. He is co-host of the Petros and Money Show on KLAC 570 AM. Hi there.
Hi, how are you, Madeline?
I'm great. Okay, so USC, great team, a record 23 wins and 11 losses this season. They are number 2 in the Pac-12 conference. So why aren't they in?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One, the Pac-12 was pretty bad this year, just as a whole, the conference. So when you take into consideration all those wins and you see them coming against teams like Washington State and Cal and Utah, and the list goes on, Oregon State, teams that weren't very good, that hurt them. So finishing second in the conference wasn't that big of a deal like it might have been in years past. Now, they also made it to the Pac-12 tournament final, which was a little bit of a bigger deal, showing that they could step up in the tournament one and done sort of environment. But kind of what everybody seems to be saying is you have these three bubble teams, USC, Oklahoma State, and Louisville, all of whom were excluded from the NCAA tournament. And those just happened to be three of the big five teams that were mentioned in that federal investigation that we actually spoke of, I don't know, about 5-6 months ago.
Yeah. Well, let's remind our listeners what that's all about.
So the feds decide that through illegal transfer of funds and wire fraud that they can go after some of these agents or assistant coaches, maybe agents of a university's basketball program that were paying to secure players to come perform at their schools. And we're still kind of awaiting the details. We've had some. The biggest story to come out of it was that the University of Arizona allegedly paid DeAndre Ayton, probably the guy who's going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft, $100,000 to choose Arizona over Kansas, which was the school he was reportedly thinking of going to. They've not been able to prove that. That's just kind of been a story that leaked out there. And USC had a player that was included and an assistant coach that was included on that list as well. That assistant coach has since been removed from the program, and the player is no longer there. So kind of Andy Enfield, the head coach of USC, is saying none of the players here, none of the coaches here had anything to do with this. It was all in the off season, and nothing was proven. So if that's the reason why they weren't included, it doesn't quite seem fair to the kids that have kind of done everything right all season long.
Right, and you mentioned Arizona. They are in the tournament.
They are in. They were the first place team in the Pac-12. They won the Pac-12 tournament. They're probably one of the 10 best teams in college basketball. So there was no leaving them out, even though they're probably the program with the player that's the highest profile in that particular, and head coach in that investigation, with ESPN, the news outlet, reporting that there is a recorded call of head coach Sean Miller specifically saying, "You'll get the cash from me," and that exchange being discussed. Now, that has not been proven. That's a single media outlet that reported that. Nobody else that regularly covers those sort of things, Yahoo specifically, was willing to go that far and say they have that sort of information.
Okay, so back up a little bit and describe how the teams are chosen in the first place, because one would think it would just be you're the best 68 teams, you're in, but that's not how it works.
This is going to get confusing because nobody really knows how they decide what 68 teams. It used to be 64, now it's 68. As you mentioned, we do have one Southern California team in, UCLA, because they are what's part of now being called the first four. That means they play two games today, two games tomorrow, between eight teams that will then narrow down to four, and those four teams will then make the 64 teams that build that bracket. Did that make sense?
No.
Okay. There used to just be 64 teams, right?
But why not just have 68 without this preliminary four-game thing?
Because the brackets wouldn't match up perfectly in those four quadrants.
I see.
Of 16 teams apiece. So each quarter quadrant has 16 teams. The winner of each quadrant then meets in what is known as their signature event, the Final Four. So in order to get one last team and expand the field, it's just dumb. I can hear myself trying to explain it, and that's all I can say. It really was a Band-Aid to cover just a gaping wound of teams complaining that it should expand to 96 teams as opposed to 64 and just be done with this. Teams are upset for getting snubbed. So let's just put that aside. I just mentioned it because that's what UCLA is doing, and they're playing tomorrow.
Okay.
And that's how they got in, as one of the last teams. The way to get in is you win your conference tournament, or if you don't have a conference tournament, you win your regular season. So all of those teams from all the conferences, from the smallest conferences to the largest conferences, get those automatic berths to be part of this. You know, the idea that a Cinderella team can win the NCAA tournament against the big powerhouses like UCLA and Kansas and Duke and Kentucky. You know, that's how we get teams like George Mason and Butler, you know, and these great stories that are so compelling and perhaps make this the best sporting event of the year. So then beyond all those, you have what are called at-large teams. And that's where things get really confusing. It's a committee of people that sit in a room and debate which remaining, say, 30 teams, however many spots there are in any given year, how which of those teams are going to be selected. You know, the teams that finished in second, finished third. Arizona State is part of it, you know, and UCLA is part of that. So that's where it gets confusing, because you don't know what they really care about. And that's what makes it, I think, frustrating, because you'll have teams, just to throw a name out there, because it's a name I think everybody recognizes, Syracuse. And it happens regularly with that team. For whatever reason, they tend to struggle in the regular season. And when they're included, people say, oh, it's Syracuse. It's Jim Boeheim. He's the head coach. coach of Syracuse. He's been there forever. The tournament loves him. So they always get the benefit of the doubt. They did not have a good season. They are not a very good team. So, you know, what's supposed to be this great moment for amateur athletics tends to get tainted a little bit by this committee that has to decide which teams deserve to be in and which teams did not make the cut.
So Bill Plaschke today, LA Times columnist, said this isn't March Madness that USC was excluded. He said it's March Lunacy. He was apoplectic.
Yes. And I think that the danger there, and I love Bill, and everybody loves Bill. He's our best columnist that we have, and he has been for quite some time. But I think the problem with that sort of line of thinking is USC is not that good. It's not like they're this great team that would have been favored to make the Final Four. It's probably the best team that USC's had in a while. And I don't know if they'll be this good again. And so I think that's probably, you know, how do you measure it? So they win two games in a tournament that you need to win six. Is it really that exciting? Did they really, really get left out of something? Because that's what they're, you know, if you were to ask people that get paid to do this for a living, or at least project how far these teams are going to go, hey, what kind of chance did SC have to win the whole thing? Almost none. Is what they would respond. So I don't know, as you described it, I don't know how one can get apoplectic about a team that has credentials that would lead you to say, yeah, they could maybe win a game or two.
Matt Moneysmith, co-host of the Petros and Money Show on KLAC 570 AM. Matt, thank you.
Sorry for confusing everyone.
It's all right. It's just March.
All right. Thanks, Madeline. Bye.
Well, here to bring some clarity is Christian Bordahl.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, Madeline.
There.
Nice to have you back.
Nice to be back.
Well, you talked earlier about Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and her interview on 60 Minutes last night. We asked our listeners for their reactions to that interview. Bob Durham says, imagine if she was the Secretary of Education. Oh, wait. Brooke Lawrence said, I think her interview shows just how unqualified she is for her job. It also underscores the fact that she could care less about quality public education, so much for draining the swamp. Triceratops says, it feels as if her entire tenure has been one long blooper reel. There was a lot of that kind of sentiment. Mm. But Janet Isler says, I like her because she isn't biased. She isn't wrapped around the finger of any teachers' unions. Some of the unions, not the teachers, have failed our students. So sad, but hopefully she'll be the one to slowly change that. And Jim Herr said, instead, she's biased in favor of greedy school privatizers who would leave schools in poor communities in even worse shape than we have put them in now. But Linda Westman said, I appreciate the fact that DeVos seems reflective and thoughtful. I see little of that with many of the Trump cabinet, but she does seem over her head with the job. Too bad she can't be better placed where she could be successful. So a little bit of both sides of everything. And then Robin Taft said, just trying to imagine what difference it makes what I think or what anyone thinks. Explain, please, how energy spent criticizing this woman's work makes any difference at all.
Hmm. Yeah, especially when the reporter we interviewed said she doesn't have much power to change policy at the local level anyway. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brack. See you tomorrow.